Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Business Brew. I'm your host, Bill Brewster. This episode features Mark Mahaney, author of Nothing But Net. Mark's book jacket describes him as the oldest and longest lasting internet analyst on Wall Street. In this conversation, we talk about his early days leading up to the internet bubble, his experience as the internet bubble burst, and what he's learned along the way. I really enjoyed his book. I enjoyed this conversation very much. I believe you all will as well. He's a really fun guy to talk to, and I'm glad that he joined the pod. His outlook on things is very different from mine, and I really appreciate him expanding my knowledge and joining the show. This episode is sponsored by Bastier Partners, a boutique investment bank. Bastier's founder and managing member is Nader Afshar, a fan of the pod. Our podcast will be forthcoming. In the meantime, know that Nader is described as a connector, high integrity, a low-key version of Byron Trott, and a rare investment banker that focuses on the alignment of interests and incentives. I appreciate him allowing me to do some calls to do some due diligence on his firm, and I appreciate his support of the pod. As always, none of this is financial advice. All of the information contained in this program is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult your financial advisor before making investment decisions and do your own due diligence. So thrilled to be joined today by Mark Mahaney, author of Nothing But Net, a book that that really pushed me to think, and I appreciate you writing it. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks, Bill.
Do you want to start off giving your background? So, you know, obviously the audience, not everybody's going to know you. So if we can start at when you became a tech analyst and some of your career, and then we'll pick the conversation up from there.
The very beginning of my book, there's a preface that's entitled "The Oldest and Longest Lasting Internet Analyst on the Street." So there, that's everything you need to know about me. I'm just kidding. So I think that would make me one of the longest and oldest, longest lasting, oldest tech analysts on the street too. I started in '98, in the spring of '98 at Morgan Stanley, working with a legendary analyst, Mary Meeker, who kind of invented the internet sector category. And at the time, there weren't that many public stocks in the space. I think it was Excite, Yahoo, Amazon, AOL, Earthlink, and Mindspring. And I don't know if anybody listening will remember Earthlink and Mindspring. But over time, you know, you got more and more market cap came into the space. Google wasn't even an idea back then. Now there was, I guess, Zuckerberg had been born then. But, you know, he was, I think he would have been an early teenager then. So there weren't any smartphones, so there was certainly no Uber. And Netflix was launched just around that time, but it wasn't streaming then. It was DVD by mail. So anyway, I wasn't there at the beginning, not like Al Gore, but I was there pretty early on. And I've been covering internet stocks flat out for 25 years now at different places. But that's been all nets, you know, Nothing But Net, the title of the book. Always online. Those have been kind of my signature email taglines for a quarter of a century. Hopefully I've learned a lot over that time period. And it's been one of the most dynamic parts and at times controversial, no doubt about it. It's been controversial at times, especially, you know, in that 99, 2000, 2001, and that the level of skepticism that quite rightly the sector faced lasted for a decade and a half after that. Even when companies like Chewy went public a few years ago, there was a hearkening back to the pets.com day. They were kind of the poster child, the sock puppet, if you will, of irrational exuberance. So anyway, that's what I've been doing. I've been covering this sector, whether it's ad names like Facebook and Google, whether it's subscription names like Spotify, Netflix, whether it's retail names like Etsy, eBay, Amazon, and then there's just a slew of other business models that have come up over time. And I've done my best to try to stay on top of them, published a lot of research on them, and had some great calls and had some terrible calls. The book that I published tried to draw lessons from those 25 years of good and bad calls.
Yeah, I really like the format of the book. For those that don't know, there's roughly 10 lessons in there. two of which I think were titled "There Will Be Blood," right? When you pick wrong stocks and when you pick right stocks. So you've got to be willing to live through the ups and the downs. What a time to start, huh? In 98, and then watch the bubble really have a blow off top and then, kind of implode. What was that like from a career perspective? You were young at the time. Were you worried at all?
Yeah. And, I think, as I may have phrased it in the book, but I certainly thought about it, for the 98 and 99, I thought I was pure genius. In 2000 and 2001, I thought I was pure idiot. And the truth is always somewhere in the middle. And so it was an extremely volatile time. I talk about it in the book. I got laid off as the internet sector didn't need multiple analysts. I just needed one. But it was a great experience. I worked at Morgan Stanley for 5 years. And I think I said I got hired into the internet boom, and I got fired out of the internet bust. But then the sector came back, and there was this thing called eBay that at the time was bulletproof, phenomenal company. And so there are some caveats here to trying to draw investing lessons from what's been one of the biggest secular trends of the last several decades. The question is just how heavily do you want to lean into lessons from that? I think there are reasons to lean in, and it's also reasons to look for the next rounds of secular trends. But it was a fascinating experience and a great learning experience. Trial by fire.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up eBay. In my mind, I have this like rule where when value investors get interested in technology stocks, be very, very wary of what's coming next. The most recent example is Facebook. But, eBay has gone from, a growth story to now I hear it pitched as basically you're relying on habit and free cash flow yield plus some buybacks gets you to where you need to go. Yet, in your experience, how do you ride the growth curve of these companies is kind of, I think, the question that I'm coming up with. And, how do you maintain a long view while also watching like acceleration and deceleration? I think, that's a lot of the choppiness that we're seeing right now seems to be lapping tough comps.
Yeah. Let me start off this way, Bill. I think if you had looked at the internet sector back then, there were three major unknowns. Is there really going to be a large internet market? Are there really some good management teams in here? And are there viable business models in here? Those are all three good questions for a brand new sector, brand new companies. Some of it just got silly. I'd forgotten this, but Pets.com went public, and I think they had 6 months of experience as a company. Like, I just don't think anything like that would fly today, but it did back then. And probably the single best example of irrational exuberance that I can think of, but I'm sure there were others. So those are the three main questions. And, there was some phenomenal wealth creation that came out of the internet space. Some of the best performing stocks of the last 2, 5, 10 years have come from Google, Facebook, even with the recent correction. Amazon, put it in a book, it was up 160,000% since its IPO, if you had bought and held it since its IPO. Now, I think you would have been completely irrational to do that. But there was a point when it was a very rational buy. And the question is, when was that? We can go into that. And then even Netflix, and this sector, because of the secular growth, it allowed these companies to sustain premium growth for years and years. And they generally scaled into profitability. I was stopped in the hallway. I relayed this story in a book by the senior strategist at Morgan Stanley at the time, and very experienced senior strategist, now well known, regular contributor to Barron's, stopped me in the elevator and knew that I was kind of the junior person working on Amazon, put his finger in my chest and said, Amazon's never going to make any money. And my reaction was, well, I guess they won't, because you're a lot more senior than I am, and I'm just trying to earn my way. But yet Amazon did generate lots of cash flow over time and became, you know, by retail standards, highly profitable. So one of the lessons I picked up is, you know, through scale, you know, scale can solve most things. I've seen the toughest business models in much more recent history, Uber, names like Spotify, where you've got, very low gross margins. I've seen examples of companies being able to scale into profitability. So,
one thing you talked about, you know, is if you had ridden Amazon all the way, what your returns would be. The book, The Everything Store, made me realize there was no way that I could possibly ever do that, right? Like, there was just too much hair, executives leaving, the stock's down 90%. I mean, I definitely would have gotten shaken out. How do you think about inflections in for lack of a better term, a story, even though it's a company, it's not a story, but how do you think about the inflection point when you want to re-enter, or, you know, when you're watching something and you want to get in? I know that that's kind of broad.
Yeah, I got you. Let me do this, Bill. I think one of the most important lessons I talk about in the book is the importance of revenue growth. For growth investors, tech investors, you know, revenue trumps everything. And of course, earnings matter. And of course, free cash flow matters too. But the reason that people look at growth stocks is that, you know, if you can find a company that can sustain premium growth rates for quite some time, they can become wonderful compounders. I don't want to over-harp on the rule of 20, but, you know, companies that were able to sustain 20% revenue growth for years and years, they're rare. It's very few. It's the percentage of the S&P 500, which are supposedly the best companies, best stocks out there, the percentage of those that can sustain 20%, that have sustained, that are sustaining 20% revenue growth for multiple years, is, you know, low single digit percent. It's a very hard thing to do. And so when you see that, to me, that's a tell of a company that, you know, you should invest in, even though it could have been the last 2 or 3 years. And you could argue, well, that's all there is. You can't sustain that growth going forwards. I got a couple of names for you to think about. Here's the history of Google. Google generated 20% revenue growth for a full decade after reaching the $25 billion revenue run rate. That's phenomenal. Only three companies in history have done that: Amazon, Apple, and Google. And when you see companies do that, like, you know, it could be pure accident, but oftentimes it speaks to something, either something special about the... So I look for those kind of financial tells, the ability of companies to sustain premium revenue growth, because it's rare and because it's usually a tell of something else. Like what? Well, large total addressable market, very good management teams, outstanding customer value propositions, and very good product innovation. I mean, in order to do premium revenue growth, and I mean from scale, not from 50 million in revenue, I mean from a couple of hundred million in revenue or a billion in revenue, something like that, something chunky. In order to do that, you know, you've got to have that combination of those four things. And so that was the lessons. And I'm sorry, I did this not just based on the successes. Like, I looked back at what went wrong with eBay. And now eBay has been a great stock the last 2 years, but if you'd bought eBay in 2005, you would have been at the same share price in 2015. There were, you know, clear examples of companies that failed. I also looked at some of the smaller ones that saw the light of day, but just barely: Blue Apron, Zulily, Groupon. So I look for those financial tells, the ability of a company to sustain premium growth, you know, consistently sustain premium growth, not just for a quarter or two, but for a couple of years. And then I like to peel back that onion and say, well, why are they doing that? And at the end of it, I kind of boiled it down to these four things that I'm looking for that give me confidence in the ability of a company to sustain premium growth. And again, it's, you know, the bigger the market opportunity, the better the opportunity to develop, you know, really large, really consistent premium revenue growth. So I look for these total addressable market. The book goes through a couple of examples of where I was trying to figure out what the TAM really was for a name like Spotify. It wasn't obvious. And then, you look for companies that have really got compelling consumer value propositions. For one reason, and Netflix really demonstrated this, you have a compelling value proposition, that means you have pricing power. And that means that one of the unusual things about Netflix is that they started increasing pricing in 2014 and pretty much did it every other year. And they still had accelerating number of sub ads. So when you increase prices and your number of new customers accelerates, you've got pricing power. And it's based on the fact that you've got an overwhelming customer value prop. Any of us can make a decision as to whether Netflix is a great value for consumers or not. Decide it for yourself. You can also do this with other businesses too. Third is that, I really look for companies that can innovate really well. I mentioned earlier that if you had bought Amazon at the IPO and held it to today, you would have had phenomenal returns. You would have been retired many times over, but you would have been highly irrational because Amazon was so unproven early on. But somewhere along the way, Amazon should have become a core holding for tech investors. And to me, that sort of happened around 2006, 2007, 2008, somewhere in there, because the company showed this ability to really innovate. They developed this cloud business that nobody ever really thought about, except for maybe Google and Microsoft a little bit. And there's something called AWS. And I remember writing one of the first reports on that. I was skeptical about the real value proposition of AWS. But man, the ability of an online retailer to also generate a really successful enterprise offering, like, that says something about how skilled that management team and how good the product innovation is at Amazon. They also had this phenomenal success with Kindles. So, when you see companies, and Apple did this too, but that succeed and innovate in very different verticals, retail, cloud computing, electronic devices, that says something about how heightened the level of product innovation is at the company. And then the last tell of the four things I'm really looking for, TAM, value prop, product level of product innovation. The last thing I look for, and what's kind of hidden under a lot of that, is the quality of the management team. And that's a very hard thing to really assess. I love to see founder-led companies. I'm going to kind of work backwards. If you look at the largest market cap companies in the world, the tech companies, they pretty much all are founder-led or were heavily run by founders for a substantial period of time. And I don't know why they have to be more, and there are some examples of companies that aren't founder-led that I think can be very good investments. Uber is one. Priceline or Booking.com is another one too. And of course, if you had bad founders, well, that doesn't help you. But if you have a good founder, there's just something about their ability to, think beyond the quarter, to think long-term, to be willing to make long-term investment bets. Bezos, my quick example here is when he launched Amazon Prime back in 2012, 2013, something like that. And I remember I wrote a note on it that night. They were going to do earnings. And earlier in the day, they announced the launch of Amazon Prime for the first time. This for $79, that's what it was back then, you would get essentially free shipping. And in that press release, Bezos also acknowledged that this is gonna cause a financial knock to our results. And sure enough, later that day, Amazon actually printed its quarterly results. It was the March quarter results, and they took down their forward operating income guidance, and the stock got whacked over the next couple of months. Fell as much as 30-40% or something like that. But Bezos absolutely made the right bet, he must have known that the street was going to punish him for near-term operating income losses, but he created one of the greatest customer satisfaction, customer retention tools, customer clubs of all time. There's over 200 million Prime customers now that are really locked in, sounds antitrust-ish, but that are really thoroughly...
Well, they're locked in from a habit perspective, right?
Yes, yeah. So anyway, that's it. And I do think it. Founders are willing to take those the hits, the near term hits, probably more than professional managers are. So that's kind of the last thing I look for.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. I think the thing that's tough. I've got two different forks, so we'll go at one of them first. It's tougher for me to look at some of these revenue growth companies and then look at the current expense structure and then try to figure out what the actual underlying margin structure of the business looks like ex growth spend, right? So how do you think about deciphering how much is this company spending because they're looking to innovate the next product versus what's sort of maintenance, for lack of a better term. Because sometimes when, you know, it appears to me that the need to innovate is a constant cycle, that like the free cash flow is always on the come but never comes, but the stocks work like crazy, and it's forcing me to ask myself, what am I actually missing here?
Let me try this. Sometimes it's very hard to peel apart maintenance versus growth investments. The mistakes I've seen, you know, like I referred to eBay and Yahoo. Those are the shoulda, coulda stories. And so maybe this is going to answer your question. eBay and Yahoo were phenomenal stocks. For Yahoo's a phenomenal stock for about 2 or 3 years. eBay was a phenomenal stock for about 5 years. And 5 or 6 years, which is great. So, you know, hats off to them, up until about 2005. And both of those companies took up their margins pretty aggressively. They reported rising operating margins and were really proud of it too. And yet, you know, there's this Apple, and then Google was almost on its own. It had such a high margin business to begin with. But that Google's market cap, that could have been Yahoo's. Amazon's market cap, that could have been eBay's. But those companies kind of missed some major opportunities. They probably didn't invest aggressively enough. They probably over-earned. It's easy to say in hindsight, but I think that's exactly what happened with those companies. You know, the e-commerce market ended up being a lot bigger than we all thought. But eBay could have tapped into that. And by not investing aggressively, and maybe they should have vertically integrated and never wanted to get into that messy distribution centers, never wanted to manage fulfillment. They wanted to be a virtual marketplace. And at the end of the day, what that meant was a less customer-friendly experience with eBay. Higher margins, great. You got the margins. But you cut off your future growth, or you limited your future growth. So I don't know. Hopefully that's a little bit of a answer to your question. And let me try something else, which is, you know, one of the problems, and I certainly understand a lot of these tech stocks. Look at the NASDAQ offerings. So many of them come public with no profits. So why should you step in and buy them? I mean, the correct approach may well be, I'm just going to wait until they can prove that they can consistently generate profits before I buy them. I may miss out on some of that early speculative move, but I'm going to sleep better at night, and I'll better manage my risk and my reward. And I have a section in the book where I just talk about, how do you value unprofitable companies? And to me, this may not be that helpful to value investors, but it's, I kind of leave the math behind, and I really focus on logic, which is, are there the reason that Twitter, Pinterest, and Snapchat had pretty robust welcomings onto the public markets, even though they weren't profitable, is that there was a company just like them called Facebook that had been on the market for multiple years and was highly profitable. We knew what social media companies could do. They're wonderful business models, by the way, because you get your users to generate all the content. You don't have to pay them for it. So great. We should all have thought of that business. But anyway, the four logic questions when I see these unprofitable companies come out is, well, is there a public market comp that's already profitable? Like, has the business model been proven profitable? Second question I ask is, Can you look within the company and find a portion of the business that's already profitable, like the lead market? Is there a segment that's already profitable? And it's, okay, well, if that's the case, then my guess is that the rest of the business, you know, assuming it's relatively similar, can also move its way to profitability. Like, I'm looking for a profitability proof point within the company. Third is, you know, I ask myself the question, is there any reason why scale can't drive a business to profitability? I mean, that was my lesson from Amazon, which is, you know, it's always a very thin margin business. So that means, you know, with thin operating, incremental operating margin business, that means fixed cost is going to lose money. But with enough scale, they'll be able to generate profits to cover the fixed cost. That's in fact exactly what happened with Amazon. And it happened with other businesses I thought it could happen with, which is Uber. So you really push yourself. Is there a particular reason why scale won't drive the business to profitability, then you have to ask yourself, do they have a good scale strategy, i.e. do they have a good growth strategy? And then the final thing is, are there specific steps that they can take to, you know, reduce losses? And Uber is a wonderful example of this. They go public, they have assets all around the world in terms of Uber Eats in Korea and ride sharing in Russia, places where they probably shouldn't have been in the first place. And under new management, they started cutting out all these loss generating areas. So like, if you can find businesses that are just too spread out, but, you know, you think that the right manager could, you know, start cutting off some of those loss generating areas, then yeah, if there's specific steps the companies can take to drive themselves towards profitability, I know it's profitless now, but there's good reasons to think it will be profitable. And I love these inflection points. As stocks, they can be great when companies sustain premium growth and then turn the corner from losing money to generating money. Then you just wide open that earnings growth aperture. So that may sound a little momentum-y to you. It's not really value oriented, but I just, you know, like you can wait for these companies to generate profits. You don't have to swing at any of these. I'm more struck by the ability companies that people were really skeptical about could generate profits ended up doing so through a scale and selective actions by the management teams. And so I'm less turned off by companies that don't generate profits. If I get a chance to invest in them early stage, great. I mean, so there's just more upside for me.
Yeah. Well, to be clear, I think that the value bent or whatever that I have and certainly had more of has made me miss a lot of these things, and it didn't help that I let the person that I look up to the most say that tech was unpredictable, and rather than think for myself, I outsourced my thinking, which is the violation of rule number one. I think he would not be proud that I did that. So I'm trying to get better, and talking to you and people like you is helping. So one of the things that I've been thinking about since you read your book, you dedicate a lot of time to Facebook. I don't want to go too long on it because it's such a well-covered name, but you've got management that clearly has sacrificed short-term profitability in the past, has had a long-term vision, I would argue has under-monetized some assets, and then Mr. Zuckerberg comes out with this metaverse concept. How do you frame what's going on with their metaverse ambitions, and what it is? Certainly, I think that decision has muddied the story, and the stock has somewhat reacted to that and somewhat reacted to deceleration in the growth. But how do you kind of think through what's going on over there with $10 billion to spend a year?
So Facebook, I like Facebook here. It is one of those DHQ stocks, dislocated high quality. So yeah, did they take down margins and investment cycles? Yeah, but they're still doing north of 30%, you know, operating margins during an investment cycle. That just tells you how robust the business model is during an investment cycle. They're doing 30 to 35% gap operating margins. Wow, what a great business that is. And they do generate a lot of cash. They've got a large balance now at 50, 60 billion. And they're using that to start stepping up materially, buying back stocks. So they're doing kind of the right thing with it in terms of capital allocation strategies. This is a company that's clearly founder-led. In fact, of all the major tech, the largest tech companies, this is the only one that's still founder-led. That's Facebook, yeah, and Zuckerberg. That's not the case with Amazon, not the case with Microsoft, not the case with Apple, and not the case with Google. Is that good or bad? I don't know. But Zuckerberg, I think it's generally good. Zuckerberg, in my mind, he doesn't get the credit for it. Maybe he shouldn't. But, you know, he obviously did a pretty darn good job with Facebook and then acquiring Instagram. And then we'll see about acquiring, about his the success in his acquisition of WhatsApp. But, you know, he does own the two largest social media assets in the world, the two largest messaging platforms in the world, with a very robust business model. This investing in the metaverse, okay, I think it's, I think about this like with Google and Waymo. I think Google or Alphabet is worth more because of its investment in Waymo. It's kind of like option value. it may come out and be worth zero. By the way, I think that's what the market's giving it. But, you know, they could become the operating system for the Jetson era, you know, the operating system for driverless cars. That's got to be worth something. And I don't know whether driverless cars will exist or not. If you give me a long enough time horizon, I'd probably take the over on that. I probably would be long the idea that and there'd be a lot of societal advantages to that, I think, including fewer car deaths, most important of which is the most important. But I like these companies that do these kind of long-term bets. And Google has been spending about $5 billion a year on Waymo, losing about $5 billion a year, which is a lot, but maybe not so much versus its P&L. Facebook is sort of doing the same thing with Metaverse. And, you know, there's a vision here, and I don't know whether this is going to be true or not, but, you know, there's no question that Mark Zuckerberg has been absolutely visionary when it comes to social media. So I'm going to give him a little bit of credit that he may be right in terms of for gaming, maybe for social interactions, and I don't know, maybe for productivity, office productivity, work interactions, that we will be using more virtual reality. We'll be looking for more immersive experiences. Just step back for a second, Bill. Just in the last 2 years, we've become a lot, our internet interactions have become a lot more immersive. What do I mean? Well, what we're doing right now, you know, podcasting has become a lot bigger in the last 2 years. Visual communications have become a lot more prevalent. They're almost the norm now. And so, yeah, we've already leaned into becoming more immersive, into more immersive connectivity. And Zuckerberg is saying we're going to lean even further. And in virtual realities, really feel like we're experiencing something with other people, not just in this, what are we doing here, two-dimensional interactions, but, you know, kind of in a virtual three-dimensional context. You know, maybe, but I'm just intrigued by this guy's been successful at predicting one trend, social media, dramatically successful. We've lived through a very brief period of time where our interactions have become more immersive, absolutely, we've become zoomed. So could we take it a step further and go to virtual reality? I think there's a distinct possibility that will happen. So yeah, I think it's probably a good bet by Zuckerberg. Would I prefer if it was $5 billion, you know, Google-esque, Waymo, $5 billion of losses a year? Yes. And I sort of wonder how they got the $10 billion. We had estimated it was more like $6 billion. They may have rounded up a little bit. But nonetheless, I think these kind of long-term option bets are the right things for companies to do. I think in hindsight, I bet you eBay wishes that they had done some options investing. And I bet you Yahoo wishes that they had some options investing, and AOL too. So generally the companies that do that long-term options investing, they, you know, if they get it right, they can be worth a heck of a lot more.
Do you worry at all about the signal that it sends Instagram and Facebook Blue employees to change the name of the company and dedicate so many resources? I'd imagine Mark is like heavily focused on sort of this new area. The only concern that I have for that company and him doing this is that he kind of signals to the rest of the company that maybe they're not as important, and that becomes an employee retention problem, which in a business that is people driven could be an issue. But I don't know that that's a real risk. I'm just curious to hear you think about it.
I hadn't really thought about it that way. I was thinking another way to think about the risk is, what are we doing here? Google's investment in Waymo is an orthogonal option value. Like whether they succeed or not in Waymo will mean jack diddly nothing to the core search business or to YouTube or to Google Cloud. So it's just kind of out there. It's a data play. Okay, so Google's a data company, but there's no, the success or failure here with this option doesn't have any impact on the core business. That may not be the case with Metaverse. It may, if Zuckerberg could be right, that we're all moving towards we're going to move part of our experiences to virtual reality, in which case there's a defensive element to this. Like if he's accurately predicted the future, Facebook better generate, you know, a very robust, intuitive virtual reality experience, or else they're going to lose the throne of the kings and queens of social media. So that's a different way than you were thinking about it, but it, you know, both ways make you less, you know, it may not be all upside in terms of metaverse and maybe a defensive element to it. And yeah, I can see how it could. It was an odd thing. That sounds like a founder call to me. I'm just going to change the name of the company because it's my company. That sounds like founder mentality, which, you know, can rub people the wrong way. And so it's the question is whether you want to make a bet on Zuckerberg. He's done pretty well by you so far. And I like the fact that he's willing to take down margins kind of in a way that Bezos did way back when with Amazon Prime, saying this is going to gut my margins near term, but stick with me on this because I think it could be a great customer loyalty program. Check. He got that right. Zuckerberg in 2019 did the same thing in the wake of that Cambridge Analytica scandal and saying, you know, warning he was going to take down margins, going to really beef up the platform security, the security of the platform. If you invested off that and if you had bought the stock off that investment cycle in the major correction, you would have had a phenomenal return over the next 1 and 2 years. And my guess is it's the same setup now. That's my guess.
Yeah, I think I largely agree with that. For anyone that's not familiar with what's going on, I do think that the shift to short form video and replicating TikTok basically within Instagram, which is now Reels.
Yeah.
You know, I do think that impacts ad load and potential ad efficiency. So I think somebody's got to have a view on that. But over the long term, I think that they'll probably figure it out. And, you know, I've listened to him speak about his views on, you know, safety and what AI and ML can do in the metaverse. It's going to be an interesting thing to watch. I'm confident that people that dismiss the investment are too confident in their dismissal. I am not confident in what it leads to, if that makes any sense.
It does.
Yeah. Do you mind going through a little bit on your views on share-based compensation? Because this is a pushback that I often hear with tech companies. You know, you look at the operating cash flow and all of a sudden it's all stock-based comp. So what's the true cash generation in these companies? I'm curious to hear you riff on that.
No, I think my answer, I don't know if it's going to surprise you or not, but I think I'm 100% agree with what the thrust of your question is. Stock-based compensation is a form of expenses. If you didn't pay your employees with stock, you'd have to pay them with cash. You know, it's compensation to them. So, and they're rational economic beings. They can put a price on that, on the shares that you've given them and the price on the cash you've given them. That's kind of easy. So I treat it as a real expense. I don't look at non-GAAP earnings. Now, in all fairness, that wasn't the case early on. So I learned along the way. I referred to it, I don't know, 7 years ago as the gapification of the internet, like the GAAP, gapification of the internet. I thought that was a healthy thing. It seemed to me like there were too many companies giving out stock like candy. And, you know, to their credit, Netflix, I don't think they ever reported a non-GAAP earnings number. Amazon hasn't in a decade. Facebook and Google both did for a short period of time, and then they cut that out. Shockingly, there's only one major internet company. That's not quite right, but the one that really strikes me as odd is this eBay, which always refers to non-GAAP earnings. It's like, really, why are we doing this? I'm treating your expenses. So when I look at PE multiples, you know, I look at GAAP PE multiples, you know, versus the growth rate to determine what I think fair value is. That's my shortcut outside of the DCF. And the DCF I look at the cash required to that's used to buy back stock to offset the share-based compensation. So absolutely, it's an economic expense and it's a financial expense. It may not be a cash expense right now, but now there's depreciation. I still consider that an expense. So yeah, I think that would be copacetic with your view.
Yeah, I heard somebody, they go by Postmarket on Twitter, but they said something super smart where they said that basically they refer to it in the office as phantom OPEX. And whenever I look at the buyback to offset the shares that are issued, it's like, this is just OPEX, right? Or it's dilution.
Yes, completely agree.
But I have morphed a little bit in my opinion, because I do understand the idea of having your employees motivated. And I also understand the idea of investing in growth if you truly believe that you're going after a market that is going to be long-term profitable. I do understand spending. I used to favor profitable growth way too much. And I think that that's probably where people like myself have missed on some pretty big trends.
Well,
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you may have missed some winners. I know you missed some losers too. I'm not a portfolio strategist, but I'm perfectly respectful of the fact that the growth equities I look at should only be a portion of your overall investment outlook. I love finding these compounders, companies that. You know, the ideal situation for me as a stock picker is to find a company where I can get a double barreled win, where I think I can get a re-rating and a multiple. And I think three barrels, if such a thing exists, where I think I can get upwards estimates revisions and where the earnings growth by itself, it can be 20%. And I look at the drivers of earnings growth. You know, the best, highest quality driver of earnings growth that I look at is revenue growth. Then margin expansion, then share buybacks and the stuff you do below the operating income line. I think tech investors spend a lot more, willing to pay a lot more for revenue growth because that's the toughest trick to pull off. And if you can pull it off, that probably says something interesting about your TAM, management team, value prop, and your level of product innovation. So I like to find those companies that if you can trade at a market multiple. One of my favorite stocks, and I spent a fair amount of time in the book on it, is Priceline.com, now known as Booking. Priceline, for a decade, mm-hmm. was the single best performing S&P 500 stock. Just a phenomenal outperformer. And they had this funny thing where for about a decade, 8 years, they grew their top line about 40%. And yet they traded between 17 times earnings, kind of close to a market multiple on GAAP, 17 and like 25 times earnings, like at a huge discount to their growth rate. And what was happening throughout this entire period is that investors were just skeptical. They thought there was too much commodity risk. They're just reselling hotel rooms. I mean, who can't do that? How are they going to be able to sustain this growth? And yet they kept sustaining that growth. And so it led to this phenomenal stock because the multiple didn't change, but the revenue growth and earnings growth was, you know, the margins were rising during that time. So you had a company that was doing 50% earnings growth for 5 years. And all you have to do is keep the multiple, and that stock is going to dramatically outperform any market. And I love to find those situations. They rarely occur. Like if I'm looking for stocks, I can find stocks that are trading at a discount or the earnings growth rate. That was the lesson from Priceline for me. Man, I love those. If they trade at these really high multiples, then it's almost like growth investors are playing a little bit of a game. Are the earnings going to grow fast enough to offset what's going to be eventual, you know, derating in the multiple? And, you know, you're kind of toggling back and forth and you're always nervous about that. How quick is that multiple going to come down? And then you get these terrible double whammies the other way. I mean, there's double barreled up and double barreled down because, when these high multiple stocks, they miss, well, shoot, estimates go down and then the stock derates. Like that's a double whammy and it can happen awfully quickly. So that's the risk with holding high multiple stocks. You better have a darn lot of confidence in that growth rate. And, I don't mind, you know, sticking my neck out on some of those high multiple stocks, but I'm going to be right up front about, well, that's the risk you're taking on. This is why I think the growth can be truly exceptional, but it better be truly exceptional or else, you know, that. So I'm fine with speculative longs. I prefer core longs.
So, you know, something that I thought was interesting is you had said at the very end of your book, what was it? It was like extra credit is what you said. You said material revenue growth acceleration is great, but it's more impressive if it's faster than the rate at which comps eased in the prior year. Likewise, material revenue. And you issued kind of a warning on the COVID beneficiary work from home stocks. And boy, was that prescient. If you look at what has gone on in that sector in general, we're now trading below 2019 multiples in a lot of cases. It's as if COVID never even happened. And I think it's a very interesting observation or set of facts here, where I think some of these companies that are objectively stronger have now had some of those growth rates put in question, even though I think that their businesses have been somewhat proven. I don't know. It's one of those scenarios where they got all the benefit in 2020 of the revenue growth, couldn't quite scale up the OpEx to go along with it. Now some of them are catching up on the OpEx, but the revenue is decelerating and you just see this compression. And I think of it a lot as like the fog of war in this sector right now. There must be opportunity is all that I can think.
I like the way you set it up, Bill. I'll make 2 points, which is you had a good number of stocks that traded up like they were COVID winners, as crude as that term is, in the back half of 2020. And if you could have correctly identified the companies that, they probably weren't COVID winners. There's a couple of – Netflix is a COVID winner. Yes, of course it is. They had a huge jump up in subs in the first half of 20. But, you know, other companies are trading like they're COVID winners, but there aren't. If you had identified those, Pinterest is actually a good example of one that traded like it was a COVID winner, stock gapped up, re-rated. But in the end of the day, they had this slew of new users that came on, about 9, 10 million in the U.S. They gave them all back. Following quarters. Now, so that's the past. Let's go to the present. So I see five stocks. And Bill, I'll even be tighter on what you just started off as the analysis. I was just thinking about this recently. I just ran this yesterday. There are five stocks that I think are clear COVID winners. Their businesses benefited from the COVID crisis. They got a bunch of new customers and at very low customer acquisition costs. You know, like people went looking for Netflix. They went looking for Peloton. Netflix and Peloton didn't have to advertise. So very low customer acquisition costs, slew of new customers. And yet these five stocks are all trading below where they were pre-COVID. Like if you go back to the middle of February 2020, their stock prices, not their multiples, multiples are probably below. I just meant they're just their freaking stock prices. And so here's the list. Shopify, Netflix, Roku, Peloton, and maybe Wix. Those five names are all trading below where they were pre-COVID. Yet, I think all of them are bigger businesses because of COVID. So chances are, in that list of five stocks, there should be some good long ideas in there. The one challenge with Shopify is that was a high multiple stock. And so we have this other trend that's going on now that I talked about at the end of the book too. So I was prescient on, maybe unfortunately prescient on, which is, you know, what happens to this sector in a rising rate environment, in an aggressively uncertain rising rate environment. Well, we know we're in a bear market for NASDAQ stocks, for tech stocks, for growth equities. Anyway, my team are looking at these five names saying, which of these should we be aggressively recommending now? Because they're fundamentally stronger than they were pre-COVID, but their market value is actually lower than it was, unless their market value was really artificially trumped, you know, a high prior to COVID, which could arguably be the case in the example of Shopify. I don't think it's the case with Netflix, Roku, Peloton, or Wix. So I'm intrigued by those four.
Yeah, I spend a lot of my time thinking about media, and I go back and forth on whether or not I think Netflix wins because they are completely dedicated to SVOD and no one else is going to be. And then recently I've sort of shifted to, well, wait a second, could Netflix and Roku both win? And Roku is the arms dealer to the companies that have to straddle sort of the AVOD, SVOD decisions. And I don't know, but I agree with you. I've heard people tell me that Roku's too cheap, but you can't buy it. And I understand that statement, and I also don't understand that statement at all. So well, it's an interesting time.
Well, this is when you step in on these. We saw this at the end of 2018. Bill, you'll remember this. You know, we had a dramatic sell-off in NASDAQ. That's the last time we had a major correction. Why? And I had to dig back into this because I was looking at Amazon, trying to draw lessons from Amazon. And when you look back at the chart on Amazon, You know, you see this outlier event where the stock corrected 30% in the back half of 2018. And when I was writing the book, I'd sort of forgotten why it corrected like that. So I went back, I looked at the earnings. Nope, no problem in the earnings. Like I literally went back and read the transcripts and the earnings reports. Like numbers actually, street numbers actually went up. So there wasn't something company specific. And then I looked at it and you had a trade war back then between the US and China. You had a new Fed Powell had just come in and was talking about raising rates. And then you had slowing global GDP growth. That was your cocktail that caused that NASDAQ correction. And NASDAQ corrected 20%, Amazon corrected 30%, although nothing had changed in Amazon's fundamentals. And that created this great DHQ, dislocated high quality opportunity to buy Amazon. You would have had a really good return if you had done that. I think that's what we got now. So I get it. I understand why. And I think growth equities are in the strike zone is the wrong word. They're not. I mean, the market's not looking to buy growth equities, and I don't think will for a while, probably not until the summer. We need some interest rate, leaving aside the Russian war on Ukraine. You know, you need some confidence in what's going to happen to interest rates. Growth equities can outperform in a rising rate environment. It's harder than in a falling rate environment, but they can. But you at least need some confidence that we're going 25, 25, 25, and how many increases, rather than in the last 6 months, we've gone from one rate increase in 22 to 4 to 5 to 6 to 7. Are we doing 25 bips, 50 bips? And that uncertainty, growth equities get crushed, and that's exactly what's happened. But throughout all this, let's take a look. So that means the high quality names actually outperformed, but they're still off. They've outperformed the more speculative names. Here's your chance to wade in. You can buy Google on sale. You can buy Amazon on sale. You can buy Apple and Microsoft, the four highest quality tech growth equities out there. They're all off, 10 to 15%. So, it's not a gimme, but when growth equities come back, and my guess is that they will at some point later this year, the market will pay more. We'll want to buy companies that can grow at premium levels, at reasonable prices. Well, we're now at reasonable prices. And so anyway, I'm very intrigued by this DHQ opportunity. You mentioned this earlier on. The first two chapters of the book are There Will Be Blood. You can pick the absolute best management team, best product innovation company, great TAM company, total adjustable market company. You can pick a great stock, but you'll lose money because the market rolls over on stuff you can't forecast. COVID, Russia invasion of Ukraine, dramatically rising interest rate, uncertain interest rate environment. That's your opportunity to step in on the highest quality names. And so that's when you should, have the confidence of your, convictions. And that's what I do. Now, the question is whether this is, and I can't call bottom on this. I just know that, and I went through this example in the book of, if I bought these stocks, identify the highest quality assets and then wait for them to be dislocated, i.e. they trade at a discount to their growth rates, or they're just, simple rule of thumb, they're off 20%. If you had bought these stocks when they were off 20%, in some cases they ended up being off 30 and 40%, but you still would have made money buying that 20% correction. So that's what I'm doing on the highest quality names. My top picks here are names like Amazon and Google. And then I also like some of these recovery names because, we will be coming out of COVID. We are coming out of COVID. And so these recovery names, like Booking and Uber and Expedia and Lyft, you get improving fundamentals. And then as the appetite recovers for growth equities, there's a lot of jet fuel behind those stocks, especially with names. I call them Venn diagram names because they're high quality in terms of business model and valuation. Bookings and Expedia always have had high margins, 30% plus EBITDA margins, generate cash, buy back stock, just high quality business models, been tested for over a decade. And their valuations are reasonably close to market multiples. And yet they've got this, it's going to be a dramatic recovery in leisure travel, this year and into next year. And these companies should really be nicely levered to that. I call them Venn diagram names, recovery and high quality. I want to be along that basket. I'll buy them here. I doubt I'll call the bottom. And I wouldn't be surprised to see them lag for another 3 months or something like that. But I just like the entry points, and I'll let the market figure out exactly when we're gonna regain our appetite in growth equities.
How do you think about something like Etsy, which is a marketplace business model, which is a fantastic business model, not quite in that second Venn diagram, right? Because they're arguably a loser as people lean more into like physical retail, but I think it's hard to argue that they haven't drawn more people onto the marketplace. And marketplaces over time tend to get stronger unless they pull an eBay, you know, and kind of stop investing, right? But I would think that going forward, if I were to think about it, I would say, okay, I want to know that they are investing and being innovative. And even if maybe I am not benefiting from the reopening, that's a heck of a business. It's probably going to be here for a while, but maybe I'm wrong on that. I don't, you know, to any listener, I haven't done deep work, so don't hold me to that comment.
Yeah, I we clearly had an inflection towards online retail sales, a little bit of a shuffle back towards offline retail sales as people were thrilled halfway through last year to be able to get out and go to the mall again. But the growth rates for online retail still remain elevated. So I still haven't figured out the right way to phrase this. Pull forward sounds like you've just taken from the future and pulled it forward. I use this expression, permanent pull forward. I'm not sure that really got it across. It's kind of like we were like 15% of retail sales were online. During COVID, it gapped up to 20%. It's not going back to 15. It's going to keep growing from there. It'll, you know, so we were going like 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 20. And then I think we go 20, 21, 22, 23. So it still keeps rising. We do have this little shuffle back to offline, but I think that's for a short period of time. So.
Well, it's almost like a step change, right?
Yes. Yes. Thank you. That's the way to phrase it. Yes.
Yeah. And then, if you really want to get complicated, maybe you're living in a split level and you got to walk down a little bit, but then it'll keep going up. I don't know. Yeah. But I think objectively, we're going to be higher than we were coming into COVID on the back end of all this. What precisely that work looks like is tough. Something I really liked about what you, I mean, I like the whole book, man. I really do appreciate you writing this, but I really liked when you said, don't get hung up on false precision. And then you went through, you know, a DCF that's 10 years long. You've got what, 70 inputs at least, right? Yeah. How many of those could go wrong? So I thought that was a nice way to kind of frame, you know, just kind of embracing the imprecision of all this.
Yeah, estimates are about the future, and you can predict the future as well as I can, which is as well as anybody else, which is you can't. So it just, you know, put a little. That's why I like these. That's why I do, you know, like, but I do think that's why they always say, what is it? Past performance is no indicator of future performance, something like that. That's that tagline and that the SEC requires in all financial prospectuses. Now, I think when it comes to management teams, past performance can be an indicator of future performance. It's possible the management team just gets lucky and lucky, you know, year in and year out. But usually, you know, you get a company like an Apple, Microsoft, Google, you know, they can sustain premium. They can sustain premium fundamentals for a sustained period of time. They've got something going for them. It's either the management structure, the market opportunity. And this stuff can be squandered over time. Yahoo squandered it. eBay squandered it. And the companies I looked at much more recently, Grubhub squandered it. They were also, though, tapping into a market that was very early stage, and that's a company kind of like eBay. They ramped up margins too quickly. So anyway, I do try to be careful with, I try to come up with a range when I think about, you know, where a stock can go to. I try to come up with a range of where I think shares can go, what could happen to the multiple, what could happen to the earnings. That's my shortcut on these names. I do have DCFs on all the names I look at, but I don't lead with a DCF. I like to see what assumptions you have to believe in a DCF in order to, you know, what DCF inputs do you have to believe in order to justify a higher price target. So that's my little bit of my sanity check, but it's a check. It's not the driver of valuation for the reason you mentioned, which is, the perfection is can be the enemy of the good.
Yeah. It's almost like embracing, it's the marriage of qualitative plus expectations investing. I think that's, yes, that's where I'm going and where I've sort of morphed as an investor. I can tell you every time that I have figured I don't like I'm uncomfortable with parts of the story, but boy, the valuation supports some of this discomfort. It has never worked. So I am no longer a valuation first thinker. But, you know, we'll see whether or not that's a good thing to morph on. You know, something, I don't know why I'm thinking of this, but I lived in Chicago for a long time. And a business that was interesting to watch stumble was Groupon.
Yes.
And, you know, seeing it, it goes to sort of like being accurate on TAM. When they started to expand outside of restaurants and they got into like this Yelpy type, you know, we're gonna start selling canoe trips and stuff like that. It really felt like the brand took a hit. And it's an interesting, maybe that's wrong to me, but that's when it felt like Chicago as a city kind of, I don't know. My friends stopped using Groupon nearly as much when it became ubiquitous, which I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah, Groupon was a fascinating example. I mean, that company went public, enormous initial public market enthusiasm for them, a highly innovative business model. A CEO that just looked like he was one of those, you know, geniuses. A business that was so popular, there was like 700 Groupon copycats. And a TAM that seemed really large. They were the fastest company to reach $1 billion in revenue, you know, ever. And they, you know, Google had tried to buy them. Well, that sounds like their strategic interest. And so the company with a big market cap thought there was something interesting in this business model. And then it all kind of fell apart. And so I don't, that's a tough one. You know, your growth investors jumped in and I was generally pretty cautious on it from the beginning. So I got lucky on that one, perhaps. And I don't know what the issue was. And this is going back a couple of years, but I think one of them, and I wrote about this a little bit in the book, but one of them was the fact that there were 700 copycats. Like what's going to cause this name to why are people going to use this versus other services? And man, that company also just extended itself into mm-hmm. so many different verticals, so many different countries. It was just like imperial overreach on mm-hmm. their part. And then they had a fair amount of management turnover in short order. I quoted it in the book, the resignation letter by Andrew Mason. I just thought it was, you know, it was humorous. Self-deprecating. And so I appreciate a little bit of levity on Wall Street. You don't get it too often. But that may have been a case that they just didn't have the right, managers running the business. And it was the value prop may have been more limited than people realized, not so much for consumers, but for merchants, because you were bringing into Groupon's pitch to merchants as, we're going to bring you in new merchants. But then the subtitle of that pitch was, we're bringing in you merchants that are really looking for a deal. I.e., yes. You know, they're going to go to your flower shop. They're going to take out your pizza because we're giving them 20% off. Like, yep. That doesn't necessarily, that strikes me as a cheap customer is the wrong word, but a deal seeking customer. So they're
going to
a deal rather than in your brand. And so how good of an acquisition channel really is that? That may have been, at the end of the day, that kind of the Achilles heel of Groupon, that they generated new incremental customer demand, but it was for deals rather than for brands or for particular services, which meant that they were lower quality new customers.
Yeah, 100%, because the customer's relationship was with Groupon to get a coupon, and then yes. they would go spend that, and it was not with Roy's Italian. Well, Roy is not an Italian restaurant owner, but anyway. We agree. Mark Mahaney, thank you so much for your time, and thank you for writing the book. I think everyone should go out and buy it. I think it's great, and I appreciate you being a guest.
Thank you, Bill. It's great talking with you. Absolutely.